I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Robert Tercek is an acclaimed and renowned digital technology expert who joins me now to talk about his new book, Vaporized: Solid Strategies for Success in a Dematerialized World. We'll talk about what it means to be vaporized and what being dematerialized means. The mobile economy is changing how people live and work. It's also changing how we view the world. When a business gets vaporized, it usually means it's rendered gone, obsolete, or changed forever. Look at a company like Kodak and how film, its primary product for at least one century, was no longer necessary. Kodak is vaporized. At the same time, the world is dematerialized. Mr. Tercek, who joins me in person this morning, is sitting in an office filled with books, DVDs, and CDs. Remember those? Well, thanks to technology and dematerialization, a lot of people no longer have physical books, DVDs, or CDs. I started Mr. Tercek's book a day ago, and it's quite engaging and interesting. For example, he talks in the book about robots and the role they could play and will play in our lives, how the app is the thing, and just how quickly startups like Spotify, Netflix, Airbnb, and Uber, well, not yet in Vancouver for Uber, are such a part of our lives now. Robert Tercek has launched new services on every digital platform, including the first video on mobile phones, the first multimedia games, to entire television networks. He's been associated with organizations like MTV, Sony Pictures, and most recently OWN, the Oprah Winfrey Network, where he was president of digital media. He's consulted with organizations like Turner Broadcasting, Interpublic Group, and PBS, among many others. RobertTercek.com is his own website. The Twitter handle is @Superplex. The book is published by Lifetree Media. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program in person this morning, Robert Tercek. Mr. Tercek, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me here.
Thanks for coming in to do this. I appreciate it.
I'm excited to be here. I love visiting Vancouver.
Yeah. And you're from Los Angeles.
Yes.
So you don't have to deal with time and the time
issue. Time zone's okay. It's the weather that's tough. It's a little wet and cold here for me, but that's refreshing.
Did you think about how people will read this book?
Yeah, actually, the book was written at the request of a couple of consulting clients. So I spoke to the CEOs of two different companies. They said, it's great that you can give us advice, and it's great you can give us strategy, but I need something I can hand out to everybody in my company, even if they're not involved in technology, to make them aware that this is happening. And he said, frankly, one of the guys said, frankly, it's the people who aren't involved in the technology who need it the most. So I sat down to write a book that explained this idea in clear terms, accessible terms, using examples that most people are familiar with, but sometimes showing another dimension or another aspect that they might not have known, but tying it all together with one simple, unified theory. And it's this metaphor. The metaphor is vaporized. You know, the idea is basically, until fairly recently, we had one way to share information with people. If you wanted to hand information down from generation to generation, you had to make it physical in some fashion, whether it's, you know, carving on stone tablets or writing it down on a scroll. But eventually we settled on the book, and for 500 years, the printed book has been kind of the best way to transmit information. More recently, we print other kinds of things like discs and DVDs, the kinds of things you have in your room here.
Yeah.
But what's happened now with the advent of digital networks, and then most significantly with the advent of mobile phones and smartphones, is that we can now get information in a different way. It doesn't have to be in a physical form. It can be liquid form if it's on a digital network, or it can be vaporized into something that's just like atmosphere if it's on a mobile device. That's a huge shift. We take it for granted, right? We don't even think much about it. But when you download an app to your phone, there's two things that are happening. First, you're utilizing completely new technologies that were not very common back in 2000. It's a new habit that the entire world seems to have adopted. More than 4 billion people do this routinely. But the second thing is, when you buy something from a virtual store, like the Apple App Store, what you're not doing is getting in your car, driving down a street, parking in a parking lot, going into a physical store to buy a product on a shelf that was manufactured in a factory somewhere and put in a box and put on a truck and put in a warehouse and shipped over to that store. All of that stuff has been replaced by software. That's a giant trend. It's going to really shape the world that we live in significant ways. But because it's invisible, we hardly notice it. We hardly see it.
And so for all of us, most of us, we think that that leads to a better world. But there are still some people who are reticent, some people who think that having a physical book, having a DVD is a lot better than, say, streaming it or reading it off a screen.
Mm-hmm.
How do you convince those people?
Well, I don't need to do any convincing. So, some people accept the argument, and they see it, and they say, sure, that's happening, and they're glad to understand better how it works. some people simply refuse to accept it. And I've gotten used to that now because I've been dealing with this matter for 20 years or so. So I found that in every company I go to, there's always some people who are holdouts. And they say, no, that's not going to happen, or it won't happen for a long time, or we tried that in the past and it didn't work, so therefore it won't happen in the future. They're wrong. It's just that at the moment, maybe they're still right, but the world's changing so quickly. The reason we know that, Joe, is simply this. You've had this experience yourself. We can start with music. So, you know, 15 years ago, people started to adopt a new habit in mass of downloading to MP3s. Mm-hmm. As just, you know, in the recent years, they've switched from MP3 downloading to streaming. So when a service worked pretty well, and it's cheaper, faster, and better than the previous alternative, lots of people just naturally move to it. They don't really tend to think too much about it.
Yeah.
What happens then, though, is that their expectations for other things start to change. So as we started to see how convenient and easy it was to have MP3s and then later streaming services for music, we started to look at other things like television and books and wonder, well, why can't we have those in digital form as well? And then Amazon came along with the Kindle, and they did a very good job with the Kindle. They, you know, they haven't done such a great job lately with their mobile phones and stuff. But the first edition Kindle really was a game changer. It was the first time someone created an e-book that was easy to use, good battery life, it was reasonably readable. It was good enough on all the points that count. And that shifted behavior quickly, and a whole bunch of people signed up for e-books as well. You know, a whole bunch of people switched to Kindle. And then as a group, as a community, as a society, we started sitting in front of our television in our living room with our mobile phones and tablets in hand. You know, around 2010, we had modern smartphones and tablets, and a lot of people sat down and looked at the TV, and they're like, wait, here are two screens that I can touch that are responsive, they predict what I want, they have access to everything on them. And then across the room, there's this big screen, and it's relatively dumb. It's a relatively dumb screen. So our expectations about what a TV is and should be shifted by virtue of the fact that we had these two mobile devices that were so sophisticated in the same room. So now suddenly TV's going through that same shift. People think this is because, you know, Silicon Valley has some plan to destroy the TV industry or something. That's not true. Consumer expectations have shifted, and the market's evolving quickly to meet those expectations. And that spreads out to everything. That's where Uber and Airbnb are so interesting, because the mobile phone has begun to shape our perception of the real world and cause us to wonder, well, if I can summon a car on demand, why can't I get a hotel room on demand? Why can't I get groceries delivered to wherever I happen to be? Why can't I have someone fetch me something, fetch my laundry and bring it to my house? And services to serve every one of those needs have emerged almost magically.
Did the industries, though, like the traditional industries like publishing, television, movies, were they slow to react?
They're always slow to react.
Yeah.
Incumbent companies, they have two big problems on their hands. The first one is they've made a massive investment in their current infrastructure, and they have to amortize that over a very long period of time. But the second one is, frankly, laziness and a lack of vision. We can come up with very sophisticated stories to tell ourselves about why we can't make a change. Trust me, I've worked with the TV companies, and I've heard every argument you could possibly conceive of. They'll find research to convince themselves that people still like TV the way it is. They'll find research to suggest that people see it as a good value, that TV is reasonably priced. They'll find research to suggest that people actually prefer to hold a remote control that was designed 20 years ago and navigate through a screen guide that was designed in the 1990s. We know from our own personal experience that that's just not true. So those are very sophisticated stories that we tell ourselves about why we can't make a change. The reality is the market changes, and it forces companies like that to react.
And so are you finding that they can adapt quickly?
No. Most companies can't make this change fast enough. That's why I wrote the book.
Yeah.
I consider it a very important thing, a high priority, an urgent priority for most companies. Though we're talking about media, what I'm describing, the process I'm describing, extends to retail, to many manufactured products, every consumer electronics device, automobiles, and even to the factory floor, where sales force automation, supply chain management, and now robotics have begun to reshape entire businesses, manufacturing companies, in the terms of software.
And when you look at, say, how it's revolutionized, certainly not in Vancouver yet, but say Uber and how that's affected the transportation industry, taxis, etc., in other cities other than Vancouver, you look at Airbnb and hotels. When this change happens, the public, I mean, are they ahead? They're obviously ahead of where the companies are. And so how do you, say, make the companies themselves, these legacy companies, a lot more receptive to adapting to change?
So one of the things I mentioned in the book is the most difficult decision any CEO will ever make is, when should I put a bullet in the head of a business that's working perfectly well? It's a very difficult decision to make. You've got an industry that runs, it's been running this way for 20, 30 years. Imagine, in terms of a human career, that's your entire career. And the people who tend to be very successful in these companies, they're the ones who know that system the best, and they're the least likely to want to change it because they know how it works. And what you're asking them to do when you present them with this kind of change, you're asking them to change very well-known economics and very well-known market dynamics and very well-known marketing models and customer models for ones that are completely unknown. Well, that's not very exciting for most people. They'd say, why should I do it? I'm perfectly content to do this. So what you see across the board in industry after industry, whether it's medical devices or manufacturing, what you see in industry after industry is an effort to try to preserve everything the way it is for just another year or two, for the foreseeable future, which is only a couple years out. And the feeling generally is, yeah, things are changing, and that's going to hit our industry at some point, but this year we got to make the numbers this quarter. We're not changing a thing. And so you see a lot of lip service. You see companies say, yeah, we're preparing for the future because we've got a digital team, and we've got a mobile team, or we've hired an outside developer, or we've done something else. To me, this is a very dangerous route to go down because it's a form of elaborate denial. Companies are fooling themselves. They think they're fooling their shareholders or their customers because they're making a nod in the direction of the future, but they're really doing nothing fundamental to change their business. And what I'm arguing is that you have to reorient your company around software and around mobile devices, because you have to reorient your company around where the customer is today. This is not a question of whether the customer is going to mobile devices. They're already there. Mm-hmm. They're already there. Today, in Canada and the United States, most adults have a smartphone. They have it with them all the time. For most of those people, it's the number one place they turn when they want the internet or when they want information. They turn to it more frequently than television, a lot more frequently than a computer connected to a wireline connection. So this is a new habit that we have. Now, if you look at mobile as a starting point for a customer journey, for any product, it's not like they're out there searching necessarily for your product. They might start and say, yeah, I really would like to find out how I can purchase this particular thing. I'm going to start on the mobile phone. Banking is a great example. Mm-hmm. They start by looking for your banking company's app. If they don't find it, they don't stop there and put the phone down and then get in the car and drive to the bank. They'll do that as a last desperate measure if they have to. But between that first hunt on the mobile phone and that last desperate act of driving to the bank, they're going to look for every other possible alternative. And this is what companies tend to miss. The companies, the incumbent companies, these established companies that we're talking about, they have an inadequate definition of competition. Their understanding of competition is the five other companies that they've known and competed with for the past 10, 20 years. Those are companies they know very well. They're blind to these mobile and digital-only alternatives. And that blindness is a really big problem for them. It doesn't mean that they're immune. It means they're totally unaware that an entirely new market and entirely new customer behavior is occurring and growing and growing and growing. I would argue that almost all of the growth in most services is happening on digital platforms. So if you're a company that doesn't have an aggressive approach or has not prioritized this, you're not experiencing that growth, and it's invisible to you. Because it happens on a mobile phone, it's vaporized. You can't see it. You can't measure it. It's not like someone's opening up retail locations across the street from your retail locations. So it's very hard for us to observe and notice the effects of this change. But it's a big change. There's an economist that I quote, Brian Arthur, W. Brian Arthur. He's at the Santa Fe Institute. And he wrote brilliantly about digital networks and the kind of industries that emerge on them. A few years ago, he's the guy who coined the idea or the term that the winner-take-all economy, where with the first company to create a good digital marketplace that solves a problem tends to take most of that market. That's an effect we've seen again and again, winner-take-all dynamics. In my book, I quote him by talking about the invisible economy or the unseen economy of software automation. These are processes that happen in the background. Every time you buy an airplane ticket, every time you ship a package across the country, it's being scanned and checked in by machines along the way, barcode scanners and so on. Mm-hmm. And those machines talk to servers, and servers are in the cloud somewhere. We never see any of that. In the old days, it would have been a clerk with a cap and a jacket on, and he'd have a checkboard, and he'd be writing down something on a manifest, and there were physical paper involved and clipboards. Today, that's all been vaporized. It's all been turned into software. Well, W. Brian Arthur argues that that economy, that automated economy, grows at twice the rate of the regular economy. And I'd argue that that's where all the growth is occurring in our economy.
Are there businesses, jobs, say, that can't be vaporized?
Yeah, that's a great question. Sure there are. And I list some of those in the book. The question is, as software and robotics replaces human workers in a lot of ways, what are the jobs that are left? What are the good jobs to go to? So first one is anything dealing with the tangible world. Human beings are going to be better at that in most places than robotics for a good long time to come. Robots still lack the dexterity to do a lot of things humans can do quite easily, like walk up and down staircases while carrying something and opening doors. Like, it's really hard for a robot to do all three of those things. They're getting better at it, but they're going to be very expensive. So for a period of time, you think, okay, anyone who's doing the kind of work that requires physical dexterity, and that's installing stuff, fixing stuff, plumbers, so forth, those jobs are fine. They're going to be around for a while. It also means any of the caring professions, physical therapy, nursing, doctors, and so forth, those are all going to be fine. Those jobs will be fine. In fact, they'll probably be enhanced by things like robotic surgery, but the doctor will still very much have a role, and the surgeon will still very much have a role, nurses as well. Over time, there are definitely efforts in Japan to try to find additional workers in the caring field, the caring professions, robot workers, to automate some portion of that, because it's very expensive. Healthcare is 20% of most economies. It's growing. So they have to find ways to control cost. Automation will play a role. But for the foreseeable future, those jobs seem like they're quite safe. I think that any job that involves dealing with robots, creating them, programming them, managing them, maintaining them, those jobs are going to be fine for some period of time. In fact, one of the big questions in the future will be, how well do you work with robots? That'll be a hiring criterion. People want to know, what is your experience managing and working with robots or programming robots?
Yeah.
I think also writing software will be a safer period, but there's a lot of speculation now that artificial intelligence, which is making great strides, in the next 10 years or so, AI programs will start writing their own software, and then that job might itself be vaporized. But at any rate, I feel that there's a huge numbers of jobs that can be saved. The second thing is that we're generating a lot of data. We're generating epic amounts of data. The amount of data we generate grows fourfold every 4 years. So that's a huge growth area. Think of it as like a natural resource, like an oil geyser, but it's an information geyser. And we're finding all kinds of new ways to track and record that information. So the jobs that involve handling data, managing it, analyzing it, finding patterns in it, figuring out what to do, what actionable step to do, asking questions, intelligent questions about that data, formulating those queries, and then translating the results, the returns, into actionable things. Those are great jobs, and those are going to continue to grow. That's a field to get into. One other thing to think about is any field that's about to turn into an information field. An example would be biology, whether that's agriculture or pharmaceuticals or healthcare. These are fields that are rich with information, but we haven't been able to read it very well. But now there's all kinds of technology coming to help us understand biology as an information field. Those are going to be all new jobs. So anything involving synthetic biology, programming of biology, editing genes, there's great breakthroughs happening right now with techniques like CRISPR, CRISPR-Cas9. These are techniques for editing DNA and cells. That's a new field that simply didn't exist a few years ago, and it's growing super fast, and it promises in the future that we'll be actually able to edit defects out of our cellular structure, or maybe in the future beyond that, start to edit the DNA of biological things so that we can create self-sustaining buildings or programmable by bacteria that or algae that generate fuel. I mean, there's kind of exciting visions out there, so I think there are going to be great new jobs in the future that are created by this process.
And when you read the book, you get to the end of the book, you say that all of us, really, we need to participate because we have a part to play in how this future is shaped. And if we don't, well, then we'll get left behind, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's, if you look back at the last 100 years, in 1900 in the United States, agriculture represented about 70% of all jobs. It was a big part of the economy. And today, agriculture is less than 3% of all jobs. In the early 1900s until the 1950s, so the middle part of the century, manufacturing jobs became the most significant part of the workforce. And today, manufacturing in the United States is under 10%. It's about 9% of jobs. So we still have a very healthy, robust, and very efficient and productive manufacturing sector. It just doesn't employ that many people. I think you're going to see something similar happen. And the point I'm trying to make is that we still have agriculture. We still have food. In fact, we have more food than we had in 1900. It's better food by many measures. It's more abundant. It's cheaper. We still have manufacturing. In fact, we have better products than we had in 1900, and they're more abundant and they're cheaper. So what we found are ways to replace the jobs, the manual labor tasks, and automate those with machines and then later with software and computers, eventually with robotics. We've been able to phase out those unproductive jobs and replace them with software. Machines free us to do something even better. That's the definition of productivity. If you want to increase the wealth of people, if you want to increase wages and pay people more money, which of course everyone would love to see happen, the only way to do it is to increase productivity. And what that means is the only way to do it is to destroy jobs. I know that sounds crazy. Mm-hmm. It sounds scary when I say it that way. But efficient companies are in the business of destroying jobs. And software companies destroy more jobs than any company going. That's their raison d'etre. That's why they exist. Now, that sounds totally scary when I frame it like that. And, you know, in the U.S. right now, we have a big political cycle starting, so you're going to hear all these politicians making, I think, indefensible claims about bringing jobs back and bringing back the manufacturing jobs. Those jobs are gone for good. If they come back, they're going to come back as robot jobs. There will be good jobs managing them, but they'll be 10% of the number of jobs that there were previously. The place to look is the future trends, what's emerging now, where are the opportunities, what are the greenfield opportunities created by this shift to a data-driven economy, and I think there'll be great jobs there. They're going to require different skills. They're going to require people to know how to think about software, how to architect it, how to navigate it. I write about all that in the book.
Yeah, so there's a chapter in the book about education and about how, say, that'll change, higher education especially. What about, because we've talked about companies themselves, but talk about the education sector and, say, governments themselves, because those are government itself is difficult to maneuver, let alone reform or change.
That's true.
So how does change in a dematerialized world?
Okay, great. Well, let me take the education question first. So with education, we're at the beginning of a process that I think is going to play out over the next 10 years. There have been several attempts now to create digital university equivalents. And I wrote a whole chapter about this. I'll try to summarize it here. The early experiments with digital education have been mixed, and some of them have not worked out very well. And that causes people in academia to smile, I think, to become complacent, because they look and they say, well, that didn't work. But there's one thing we know about software. Version 1 never works quite right. And version 2, they fix some of the problems, but then they find new problems, or they create new problems. It's version 3 you need to be worried about. And we're now moving into MOOC 2.0. MOOC is a massively open online curriculum. It's a course that is designed for millions of people to learn from. Now, a lot of people in the universities are very dismissive of MOOCs. They're very dismissive because they feel like they don't work, therefore we can relax, we don't have to worry about it, this doesn't present a threat. I think they're making a huge mistake. I think the MOOCs will get better and better and better. The premise of providing free education for millions of people, this is a great premise. Nothing will ever rival the experience of being at a great North American university and being on campus and being taught in a small classroom setting with a brilliant professor. Nothing will rival that. But let's get real. That's a very expensive proposition. You know, at a private university, you could spend $60,000 a year on tuition fees alone. So that's a terribly expensive proposition. It's out of reach of most people in North America, let alone most people around the world. The challenge we face as a civilization is we have to educate billions of people. That traditional university in-person setting on campus, that just doesn't scale to suit billions of people. We can't afford to do it that way. So the problem the MOOCs are trying to solve isn't at all going to disrupt the traditional university. That's a privilege that'll be there for the people who can afford it in the future. And it surely will go up in price as it is. There's no shortage of demand for that traditional university education. The number of people applying goes up and up and up. What the MOOCs are trying to do is they're trying to shift people from commodity labor, basically like, you know, a human equivalent of horsepower. And they're trying to help people cultivate their minds so that we can tap that mind power of billions of people. And we need to do that. And that's quite an urgent task. So in the book, I talk a little bit about how that'll play out. And I point out that in addition to the very big MOOCs that are designed to solve this problem for millions of people at once, there are also thousands of tiny little innovative startups that are popping up, and they're all trying to solve one piece of the problem. So they're not trying to do it in a sweeping fashion to substitute for a university. They're just trying to give people a tool they need right now so that they can pick up a skill at night while they're working and continually improve themselves. One picture for the future with education is that we're going to be a world of continuously upgrading our skill sets. Competitive pressure will force us to do that. We're going to compete against the labor pool around the world. We're also going to compete against robots and artificial intelligence. That's going to cause us to find ways to migrate our skills into places where we can't be replaced as easily. So we have to all be prepared for a lifelong learning. It's not something you do for 4 years in college and then head out to the workforce for 25 years. That's a big shift. Let's talk about government. So with government's being challenged right now. One of the observations in the book is that this idea of vaporizing businesses and replicating them in software models on the internet, that used to be confined to the web, that used to be confined to your mobile phone or your computer. But now those software models are starting to spill out into the real world. And that's really what Uber is about. Uber and Airbnb are the best examples of taking the business logic of an internet company and applying it to a real-world company. Of course, today there's hundreds of companies that are trying to be the Uber for dry cleaning or pet walking or something else. So there are lots of companies trying to replicate that in other fields. Some of them will be successful, and of course many of them won't. The point I'm trying to make is that we're rapidly becoming accustomed to businesses in the real world that operate like internet businesses, by internet rules, by internet logic. Those companies run headlong into local legislation, local rules and regulations, about how a real-world business is meant to operate. And so the first point of conflict or contentiousness between this vaporized economy and the real world is going to be government regulation, and typically municipal government regulation. So some companies like Uber run into this everywhere they go, and Airbnb does to a certain extent. Those local regulations exist for a reason. They're there to keep people safe, to make sure that they get reliable product and service and so forth. But they were written in the 1930s, largely, and it was a different time when that was the best tool they had. It was an army of inspectors and a bunch of regulations, and then you had to get a license that could be revoked, and you could not perform that service if you didn't get the license, you didn't qualify. That's how they did in the 1930s, and that system served us well until today. But I think it's safe to say that system, it certainly warrants a conversation to say, is that the best system going forward? And in the book, I raised the question, that's posed by companies like Uber. Well, can we use software to replace that regulation? Can we start to use software as a means to regulate people, to check their behavior? You know, when you ride in an Uber car, every time you're done, you get to rate the driver, and the driver gets to rate you as a customer. So Uber isn't just a marketplace for transportation. Mm. Of course, it is that. It's also a marketplace for reputation. And drivers with low, bad reputation score, they get fired. They get bounced out of the system. And riders with a bad reputation score, well, drivers don't respond when they want an Uber. It takes them a long time to get a ride, and they don't know why. They don't understand, well, Uber's not working that well. No, it's because the drivers are looking, saying, this person has a low score. I don't want them in my car. So you have a marketplace emerging there for reputation, which I think is fascinating. On the internet, this is quite common. You know, every website you go to, there are user reviews and scores, five-star rankings and so forth. That's quite normal. And on any social network, you know, there's a form of evaluating someone, you know, if you accept their friendship and so forth. So we have gotten accustomed to these user rankings and scores. Can that now be applied to ranking real businesses in the real world? That's one of the experiments that Uber is trying to do. We'll see if they succeed, but their proposal is simply that the toughest regulator in the world would be the customer himself or herself, armed with a smartphone. They can give you a real-time status on that particular service provider. Is that person any good or not? If not, they get dinged, and it's real clear, immediately transmitted to everybody else. That's much better than an annual inspection by a government inspector who may or may not be taking a bribe.
Back to one point that I found quite interesting in the book is this idea of the loss of the physical product. So as I said at the offset, we're sitting in a room with a bunch of books, a bunch of DVDs and CDs. In a ideal world, the room would probably be a lot neater and tidier without this stuff. So I'd have to make that transition, I guess. But in terms of the creative process in writing a book, creating a TV show, making a CD, making music, has that changed for the artist, the writer themselves, because of how their work is being consumed? Because it's not being consumed, say, in a traditional way?
Yeah, there's a big change. And we're seeing, I don't really cover this in depth in the book, but it's a super good question, so let me talk a little bit about it. So the process of developing or creating product has changed a lot in media, and I think it's this will eventually affect other businesses as well. In the past, in the not-so-distant past, if you were going to publish something, you needed to finish the manuscript and have what we would call a gold master in the game business. So whether it's a game or a record album or a movie or a book, mm-hmm. You have to lock off the final version. And then that gets submitted to the publisher, who then mechanically reproduces it a whole bunch on a bunch of different discs and ships them out. So you can't have a work in progress. Now, sometimes people would try to leak out, you know, previews and updates and, you know, notes from the field and previews and so forth. And that sometimes generated some fan buzz. What we're seeing happen now in the creative arts is an emerging kind of collaborative system whereby people, an artist, will run versions past people, past an audience. And so you see people doing that collaboratively with a book. They'll post it as a series of blog posts that invite questions and gets feedback from the readership. You see artists using SoundCloud in this way, where they're basically doing scratch versions, mixtapes, and so forth. We see people also using crowdfunding as a technique for this. So crowdfunding is a way of saying, hey, I've got an idea for a product. Could be a movie or a game. Might be a product, a physical product, like a watch. But I have this idea, and I figured out how to do it. Here's my plan. And here's my credentials. I've done stuff like this before, so you know I probably can. What do you think? And out of nowhere, millions of people come forth, and they say, that's a cool idea. I'd like to back that project. I'd like to see it realized. Here's the funding to do it. And so we're seeing crowdfunding campaigns that try to raise $100,000 or $200,000 to get to the first iteration of their product. And in 30 days, they're raising $2 million or $10 million, which seems extraordinary. And it doesn't happen all the time. The typical crowdfunding program raises $7,000 or $8,000. So it doesn't raise that much money. Mm-hmm. But these hits happen with frequency. And billions of dollars is being raised in crowdfunding now. So that's another way of allowing your fans to participate in the creation of a product before it even exists, long before it exists, when it's just a plan.
Well, what have, say, venture capitalists, banks, and traditional investors, what have they made of crowdfunding, and what has that done to their trade, say?
So at first, venture capitalists were skeptical of it and dismissive of it, which is very typical of anything new. You know, the incumbent people always dismiss it. But then they saw it growing. Basically, the story of crowdfunding is since 2011, the amount raised has doubled every single year. So when anything's doubling and doubling and doubling, after a couple of years, you go, okay, this is no longer just a fad. It looks like it's a long-term trend. Well, the VCs are very, very smart. So they saw that actually as something that they could work with. And specifically, if you have a product or an idea that is something that will be a consumer product at some point, it's a consumer proposition of some sort, it's very common now for a VC to say, why don't you go run a campaign on Kickstarter or Indiegogo, and let's see if you can connect with an audience, find customers, market your thing in a way that's compelling to them, and let's test the market before we put any money to work. So now they use crowdfunding as a litmus test to see whether or not they want to continue. That's a double-edged sword for the VCs, because that might be a great way to verify demand and prove, you know, kind of de-risk the investment for them. But at the same time, there's a chance that if that company does it right, if they're really successful with crowdfunding, they're not going to need the money from the VC at all. And, you know, for VCs, there's always another deal, so I don't think that's a terribly huge risk for mm-hmm. them. But it's an interesting phenomenon, because it really, if I were launching a business on Kickstarter or Indiegogo, I would seek to see if I could raise enough money so I could skip both the seed round and the Series A, or maybe even the Series B financing, simply by booking enough orders from customers. But basically, you can assume then that crowdfunding is a way to verify a proposition before making an investment, and thereby it de-risks the investment. That said, things are changing, and they're changing in a significant way. In the U.S., there was legislation passed in 2013 called JOBS, Jobs, and that's the Jumpstart Our Businesses Act, and our business startups, JOBS. And it took several years for our Securities and Exchange Commission to write the rules. But what this law does is it allows individual people to make equity investments on a crowdsourced or crowdfunded platform. That's a big shift. Today, if you back like a cool watch or video game or movie on Kickstarter, you don't get an equity stake. You're not an owner. You're entitled to get that product when it's made. So you're a backer. You're an early customer, but you're not an equity participant. But starting next spring, in spring of 2016, the SEC has finally published the rules around how to do crowdsourced equity financing. And that's very different from crowdfunding a product, because now you'll be able to raise money for a business and make all those micro investors participants in your company. It's super complicated. Nobody knows exactly how this is going to work. There's a lot of speculation about it. They'll probably have to tune the rules a few times till they get it exactly right. But there's a couple interesting observations about it. In the U.S., the only people who can make equity investments at that level today, prior to these rules, were what they call accredited investors. An accredited investor has to have a certain amount of cash. They have to make a certain amount of income. And only people above that threshold could make speculative investments of this sort. Well, that turns out that pool of what are called accredited investors, it's only about 8 or 9 million people. It's not a big number. And of them, very few of that group actually made those kinds of investments, which means that the pool available of speculative money this way is very, very small. And typically you have to know somebody to get in, to get into that pool. And that's why most venture-funded startups happen to be in Silicon Valley, Boston, and New York, because that's where the investors are. It's that simple. It really is. So if you're in Cleveland or Detroit or Indianapolis, it's really hard to raise venture funding from those companies. You're out of sight, you're out of mind. So with this Jobs Act, the notion is that they can actually kind of democratize that kind of early investment, make it available to people, admittedly with some rules, some guardrails around it so investors won't get skinned. And that way, you'll be able to do local fundraising. And so this is a cool idea for a city like Detroit that's been beaten down so badly, but there's a lot of creative people there. It's a very cost-effective place to start a business because your cost of being there isn't so high. You know, it's cheap. You can get stuff for space is cheap. Real estate is cheap. People are ready to work. There is a workforce that wants to work. So it's a great place to be an innovator. It's a hard place to raise money. The notion is that you could use a crowdfunding, a crowdsourced financing platform to bankroll a company that's designed to serve just the local community. It doesn't have to have those same characteristics that the VCs look for. VCs are always looking for a unicorn that can scale to global size. There just aren't that many of those companies. That opportunity doesn't come along that often. But there's a lot of need for us to reinvest in local businesses, to reinvent local business in our local communities. This crowdfunding idea, this crowdsourced financing idea could help solve that.
I guess the key, people want, you know, they want to be happy, they want to be productive, they want prosperity, they want profitability. So how does everyone benefit in this new digital economy? I mean, another aspect that the people want is accountability.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think those aspects of what people want, can they be ensured?
It's a great question. I mean, the big thing to consider when it comes to the mobile platforms, those platforms are private businesses that are owned by investors. And I'm referring specifically to Apple, Google, Amazon and Facebook, because those are the big four. And, of course, there are many others. And in different parts of the world, for instance, in China, there are different platforms with different names, but they all run along similar dynamics. And one of the things we observe is that at a certain size, those platforms open up, and they invite third parties to come in and build something innovative on top, build an app on top of Facebook or on top of the iPhone or on top of all those great Google services.
Mm-hmm.
And that spurs innovation, and that in turn drives consumer demand. And so it really serves the platform operator to open up with APIs and make it available for third-party companies to come in and build an app on top. So we see this tremendous wave of innovation on top. But at another level, as the company grows and grows, always what seems to happen is that platform owner starts to become envious of all those third-party developers, and they try to seize or steal back some of the value that's created. And it's a really interesting question. Like, what percentage of the value belongs to the platform for enabling it all, and what percentage belongs to the innovative app developer who built that creative thing on top? The game industry is a great illustration of this. Any game developer you talk to, they love the fact that the iPhone is such a handy game platform. Everybody's got one in their pocket. That's great. That's a huge addressable market. But nobody's happy about the fact that Apple takes 30% off the top. Now, Apple's perspective is, well, try selling your game in a store, shrink-wrapped. Mm-hmm. You'd be giving away 50% between the distributor and the retailer. You'd be lucky to end up with more with 50%. You'd probably end up with more like 30%. So our 70% share with you is very generous. And if you don't want to take, if you don't want us to take 30%, well, good luck. Go out there and distribute it yourself from your own website. Good luck with that, right? That's their stance, and they haven't been very flexible about that at all. So the developers chafe at this because the fact is they have to spend money building their apps, and then they give up 30% of the revenue to Apple but they end up spending a further 30% of what they make buying advertising to make people aware of it, because discovery is a giant problem. And where today you spend most of your money, if you're a mobile app developer, you're going to spend it on Facebook, because Facebook Mobile is app number one most people turn to. Mm-hmm. That's the best place to connect with a customer. So in effect, you're now maybe keeping 40% of the revenue that you generate, because you're giving 30% away in a platform fee and 30% away to another platform in order to get customers. It's a dynamic space. Some of the people who are successful at it say, hey, it's still the best way to reach millions of people, and I can grow a business on the back of these platforms very quickly. I could never do it any other way, so it's great, and I'm happy to pay the price. Happy to pay the price of admission. Other people don't like it. Where it starts to become problematic for them is when these companies act like bullies, and they start to change the rules in the middle of the game. They start to revoke permissions. If they see that what you're doing might, you know, threaten them in some fashion, they'll just turn your app off and make it invisible or disable it for people. And I read a little bit about that. I call them the app dictatorships. Yeah, and so people grumble about that. There's one other aspect that we should talk about. These platform companies gather one heck of a lot of data about us, where we are, and what we do, more than we even realize. Mm-hmm. And I go into some depth in the book talking about how much Google knows about you, because Google isn't limited to the mobile phone. They're on your computer. They're going to be in your car. They're now in your Nest thermostat in your house and so forth. So Google's everywhere, and they constantly are watching what you do and where you go. They know your whereabouts better than you do. They know your habits better than they do. They know them so well that they can offer a service like Google Now on Tap that will intelligently make recommendations, because they know where you're going. They know from your text messages and emails and your calendar appointments what you're planning to do when you get there. And so they also know your previous preferences. They can say, hey, there's a restaurant, a coffee shop you might want to visit on the way, or you can pick up your laundry on the way back. It's almost weird how these systems can predict what we're going to do next. So there's a question, like, how much do we want these service providers, these platforms, to know that much about us in that much detail? And I just don't know the answer to that question. That's something that we have to keep an eye on. In a way, these are quasi-governmental businesses. You know, they're starting to control and govern our behaviors.
Finally, Robert, other than flogging this book, as you are,
yes.
Did you have a job today?
Yes, of course. I'm a consultant to companies, mm-hmm. and I talk a little bit about that in the book and some of the experiences I've had. So I wrote Vaporize because I have clients who have asked me to give them something in physical form, like a book they can hand out to their staff and to their customers to acquaint them with these dynamics, and that was the origin of it.
Well, it's an engaging book. Continued good luck with it, and I appreciate your time coming in to talk about it. I could talk all day with you.
Thank you.
The website for more, RobertTersic.com. The book is called Vaporize, Solid Strategies for Success in a Dematerialized World. It's published by Lifetree Media. Its author, Robert Tersic, joined me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joel Suplanta.